Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, North America. Member FDIC.
This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
Top-notch, value-added, hot-off-the-presses news.
Bloomberg puts out thousands of news stories a day, but some really stick with you.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories, powered by 2,600 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter on this edition of Bloomberg Best for Monday, November 28th.
We wrap up the first major weekend of holiday shopping and talk about it with UPS CEO David Abney.
This year we're going to deliver over 700 million packages between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and that's an increase of 14%.
Plus, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development lifts its global growth forecast for 2017. We speak with the group's chief economist, Catherine Mann.
In the absence of fiscal stimulus around the world by the U.S., China, and the European Union, the global economy will stay stuck in its low growth trap of 3%.
And the former head of the FDIC, Sheila Bair, weighs in on bank regulation under a Trump administration.
I think the markets are getting a little ahead of themselves in terms of assuming that the regulatory policies under Mr. Trump are going to be very big bank friendly.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. Are your returns dragged down by high transaction costs? Trade up to Interactive Brokers, where our lower costs can help you maximize your returns. Visit ibkr.com/savemore for more information.
The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development is lifting its global growth forecast for 2017 and predicting expansion in 2018 will reach its fastest pace in half a decade as Donald Trump's planned fiscal stimulus provides a boost to major economies. Mike McKee and Francine Lacroix talk with the group's chief economist, Catherine Mann.
We increased our global growth forecast for 16 and 17 based on fiscal stimulus, not only in the United States or expected in the United States for 2017 and 18, but also ongoing fiscal stimulus in China and a little bit of fiscal stimulus in Europe as well. So it's not just Donald Trump. It's also, more broadly speaking, the large economies. We don't see a lot coming through until halfway through 2017 and then more in 18.
Dr. Mann, what you seem to suggest is that actually in the aftermath of the U.S. election, that there will be a significant change in direction for macroeconomic policy. So are you expecting more fiscal stimulus across the world?
So both candidates in the United States had fiscal stimulus, and particularly in infrastructure, as part of their program. So that was relatively easy to incorporate. Now, around the world, we are seeing more fiscal stimulus in our economic outlook today. We focus on Europe as having more fiscal space than it's currently tapped into using. And so part of our economic outlook is to examine how much fiscal space they have, what kind of instruments they should use to deploy that space, and what would be the implication on global growth.
But I have to ask how you plug in numbers when you don't know what is even possible in the United States. As Gideon Rose was telling us earlier, we're in uncharted territory. We have no idea what's going to happen.
It was challenging, but as I say, both candidates had the infrastructure part as part of their platform, so that gave us something to work with. In addition, there were some issues with regard to taxes that are further out in the forecast horizon, but we thought it was important to incorporate what kind of fiscal stimulus might be the case, because what we find is in the absence of fiscal stimulus around the world by the U.S., China, and the European Union, the global economy will stay stuck in its low growth trap of 3%. So the fiscal stimulus and the structural reforms that are part of that, it's interwoven spending, tax cut, and structural reforms, these are key ingredients to get us out of the low growth trap that we've been in for the past 5 years.
Right, but Catherine, what do you need to do or what needs to happen for CEOs to spend? Instead of sitting on vast amounts of cash, if they start spending and reinvesting, right, that would also go a long way.
So sure, what we've talked about, as I say, we've called it a low growth trap because there are no signals coming from consumer demand or aggregate demand in general around the world, not trade demand either. There are no market signals to generate new business investment in, you know, real plant equipment, innovation, and so forth. So the objective of a fiscal stimulus combined with structural reforms is to create both the demand side, and then the structural part is to create the environment in which business gets the signals to invest and has the capability to do so. In the longer term, that creates the underpinnings for higher productivity growth and the long-term capacity of economies to deliver for their citizens.
Catherine, let me ask you this. When you put together your latest forecast, how did you weigh the possibility of fiscal stimulus adding to growth around the world against this populist view that we should pull back, that we should throw up barriers to trade, and the world should become more focused on its own countries?
Well, in our economic outlook, we also examine the consequences of trade policy. So there are two main themes in the economic outlook. One is the fiscal initiatives, and the other one is consequences for trade. And so we examine both a positive trade scenario where we implement the trade facilitation agreement, which reduces trade costs around the world. But then, of course, we also look at a downside scenario. It's anchored in rolling back the trade liberalization that's been done since the start of the Doha Development Agenda. So it's rolling back to 2001, all the trade liberalization that's been undertaken on a bilateral and a regional basis. And we look at how, what are the consequences of that for growth and the protectionism being put on by Europe, China, and the United States. And what we find is there's a loss of about 2% of GDP, but it's mostly being in the countries that undertake the protectionism. So protectionism is bad. And we also note that 360 million jobs in the advanced countries come from foreign demand, either directly through trade across borders or by companies that trade with the companies that actually send the stuff across the border.
That was Catherine Mann, the chief economist for the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, speaking with Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix and Mike McKee.
Coming up, a conversation with a Nobel Prize-winning economist, Alvin Roth. You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg. Alvin Roth won the Nobel Prize with Lloyd Shapley in Economic Sciences in 2012. The Stanford professor is best known for his work on game theory, experimental economics, and market design. He spoke with David Gura and Francine Lacroix on Bloomberg Surveillance.
We have been talking about the process of picking cabinet appointments. Donald Trump's still selecting who's going to be his Treasury Secretary, his Secretary of State, who's going to fill the entire cabinet. Is this squarely in the world of game theory, picking people to be in a president's cabinet?
Well, only a little bit, but it is a little bit, because picking people to be in your cabinet is a way of committing to future strategy choices. The strategy space is big. Who knows what secretaries of state and presidents will have to face? But part of what presidents have to do is delegate. And when they delegate to people with particular commitments and histories, they commit themselves to future courses of action in situations that we can't yet anticipate.
Al Roth, game theory, the study of mathematical models of conflict and cooperation between intelligent, rational decision makers. Is this the game Donald Trump is playing?
Who knows? He may be trying to commit himself to strategies in order to not have to make decisions when the time comes. You know, again, government is big, and a lot of it is done by the people who a president appoints. Mr. Trump seems to be leaning towards a lot of former military men. Who knows what that might portend?
We were speaking with Gideon Rose, the editor of Foreign Affairs, earlier, and we were talking about how inchoate Donald Trump's foreign policy seems to be. Do you agree with that? When you look at his foreign policy, you look at his economic policy, does it seem unformed to you, or does it seem unknown to you?
Well, I think it's probably unformed, and therefore it's unknown. Mr. Trump has spent his career building up his family real estate business. He has not had a lot of occasion to think about foreign policy questions. They're going to come at him thick and fast now. So I think that it's probably difficult for him to know what he'll do.
but is he interested in policy? And Al, the problem that, for example, Gideon Rose was pointing or alluding to is that you can have business interests and still have an interest in foreign policy on the world that's going on around you. It seems that the president-elect at the moment doesn't have that.
So I'd have to agree with you. His campaign utterances didn't impress me as those of a man who was deeply engaged in the world and had read and thought widely. So he's going to have to make it up as we go along. We may have gotten the government we deserve.
What is your sense of what happens to multilateral trade here under a President Donald Trump? He has said on the campaign trail he is interested in renegotiating deals or scrapping deals altogether. Are the days of multilateral trade numbered?
They may be. If we don't ratify and continue to honor trade deals that have been made, then our partners, of course, won't either. Trade and to some extent climate negotiations as well are collective action problems. Everyone makes some sacrifices so that other people will make sacrifices too, so that we can all profit. And if you look at the sacrifices you're making and say, you know, who agreed to these? You know, why should we make sacrifices? Then it's likely that your partners in trade or in climate control will also be reluctant to make the sacrifices that they had agreed to make.
Al Roth, what do you mean that maybe we got the government that we deserve?
Well, we're a democracy, and we just elected Mr. Trump to be our president. So we're going to have to live with the consequences. And, of course, so will the rest of the world. So maybe we got the government we deserve. It's not clear that you got the government that you deserve.
Going back to climate change quickly here, we were talking about the prospect of Donald Trump pulling out of COP21 or you know, at least just ignoring it. In the world of game theory, how do you deal with that, with a participant just bowing out there when there has been a collective agreement?
Well, you know, collective agreements on things like climate change involve continued action. Everyone agrees to do things over a long period of time and to take costly measures for the common good, with the idea that our costly measures provide you with some good and your costly measures provide us with some good, and collectively we're all better off than if we didn't take these costly measures. But of course, if we stop paying for our share of this common good, we can expect that our partners may be more reluctant to pay their share. Or they might form together in other coalitions and try to get us to pay in other ways.
That was Nobel Prize winner Alvin Roth speaking with Bloomberg's David Gura and Francine Lacroix.
Coming up, former head of the FDIC, Sheila Bair, weighs in on banking regulation under the Trump administration.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on gold and how its epic boom and bust is renewing debate about its appeal with Bloomberg's Eddie van der Walt.
The situation.
Gold's still got its allure. It always have and it always will. People have liked this stuff for thousands of years. They're not going to stop now just because of, you know, short intraday kind of moves in the price. Gold is well loved by everybody, you know, from India to the U.S.
The background.
It was a spectacular year for gold back in 2011 when gold prices came to just short of about $2,000 an ounce. Prices have been driven up for about 10 years, starting round about with 9/11 and all of the uncertainty that created, the invention of ETFs and lots of other things happened to help propel prices higher. But the last leg came following the financial crisis in 2008.
The argument.
When investors buy gold, they're saying they are fearful. They're saying that they're worried. They're saying that they don't trust the status quo, and they're worried about how things are going to play out. When investors buy gold, they're voicing their uncertainty, and often they're just looking for an insurance policy against just global uncertainty, political uncertainty, geopolitical risk, any kind of risk that you can name.
For more on gold or other quick takes, go to BloombergView.com/quicktake, or for terminal customers, go to NIQuick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, North America. Member FDIC.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter. Bloomberg Best is brought to you by SEI. Have evolving investor and regulatory demands affected your investment firm's operational readiness? Imagine transforming your business with SEI's global platform at seic.com/imagine.
Sheila Bair is the former head of the U.S. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. She was appointed to the post in 2006 by former President George W. Bush. She left that position in 2011 when her term expired. Today, Bair is in the academic world. Last year, she was selected the 28th president of Washington College in Maryland. Bair spoke earlier with Bloomberg's Michael McKee on Bloomberg Surveillance.
Sheila, you dealt with a lot of regulation, and that is one of the things that Donald Trump particularly ran against. Is it an epochal change for the United States?
Right. Well, I think you need to differentiate financial regulation. He's not really a big fan of the big banks, at least during the campaign. And some of the people that he's talking about bringing into his administration, like Jeb Hensarling, even though they want to deregulate in certain areas, they want to ratchet up regulations in areas like capital, which I think is very important. The Republican platform also, supported restoring Glass-Steagall, which would require the big universal banks to break up. So I think the markets are getting a little ahead of themselves in terms of assuming that the regulatory policies under Mr. Trump are going to be very big bank friendly. I think for the regional banks and the small banks, there's absolutely going to be relief. But for the big banks, I'm not quite sure what's going to happen yet.
Well, when you look back, did we overregulate without thinking about the cost-benefit analysis, the old Jamie Dimon argument that he made a few years ago?
Right. Well, so I think there's not all these regulations have been smart regulations. They've been highly complex, which means they're very expensive to comply with, which actually helps the big banks. And the incremental benefit is not always as apparently significant. So I do think in certain areas we didn't have smart regulation. I think we don't need a policy of no regulation, though. We do clearly need oversight of the financial markets and financial institutions. But it needs to be smart, elegant, simple regulations that are easy to understand and enforce. And we haven't always gotten that with Dodd-Frank implementation.
Is greed back, as you postulated in your book, The Bullies of Wall Street, that greed drove Wall Street, is that going to come back now?
Right. Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, greed always drives Wall Street. I don't think we're ever going to change that. This idea that somehow regulators can change culture, I just don't think that's realistic. So they are always driven by profit making. That's not necessarily bad in a market-based economy, so long as you have some common sense oversight that aligns those economic incentives. That's why I like strong capital requirements, because it forces shareholders to put more skin in the game, more of their own money at risk, which makes them a little more prudent in their risk-taking. If you let them use a lot of leverage, which we did prior to the crisis, they're gambling with other people's money, and incentivize risk-taking. So Wall Street's always going to be greedy. I don't think we can do anything about that. That's not necessarily bad, so long as you have proper oversight. And we didn't have that prior to the crisis. We don't want to go back to that. I think it would be very ironic. You know, I would argue that Mr. Trump, one of the reasons he got elected was a continuing backlash, a populist backlash against the financial crisis and the bailouts that followed and the perceived lack of accountability. So for him to return to that kind of environment where the big banks can just, take risk in an unbridled way to give us another crisis would be truly ironic, and I hope he doesn't pursue that path.
Well, let me ask you something about your world now, and that is higher education. What do you anticipate going forward with this whole movement towards maybe we should have free college education or at least some debt forgiveness, plus the whole idea that the liberal academic elite is in retreat?
Yeah. So I think I would be very surprised if we do free college now. He was publicly against that during the campaign. He actually, in a speech in Columbus, Ohio, he seemed to be embracing a concept which I like a lot, which is the concept of income share to replace the debt that we use now to finance higher education. With income share, students simply repay what they were able to finance through government guaranteed backing by paying a percentage of their income, what they actually make when they graduate, over a longer period of time. So we have lower affordable payments, but they're paid back over a longer period of time. And if structured the right way, I think you could provide a lot of payment relief to student borrowers, but in a way that would protect taxpayers against losses.
That was the former head of the U.S. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Sheila Bair, speaking with Bloomberg's Michael McKee on Bloomberg Surveillance.
Coming up, a recap of the big holiday shopping weekend with the CEOs of UPS and HSN, owner of the Home Shopping Network.
You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
With the Bloomberg Business of Sports Report, I'm Michael Barr. It started as a gadget to control soccer fans. Now Japan's obsession to keep order and tech prowess has reached the next level. It's an intelligent megaphone that can issue commands in Chinese, English, and Korean. Panasonic has unveiled what is essentially a smartphone paired with a handheld loudspeaker. Panasonic believes that police, event organizers, and transport staff will use the device to help keep crowd control. The megaphone is able to match spoken Japanese to 300 preset expressions with a push of a button in different languages. The megaphone goes on sale on December 20th with a three-year contract that will cost less than $180 a month. The megaphone will also be marketed to airports and theme parks. Tourism is climbing in Japan, and Tokyo is bracing for visitors for the 2020 Olympics. And that is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr.
It's 48 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg View.
I'm Barry Ritholtz, a columnist for Bloomberg View. The election lessons that apply to investing just keep coming. The latest, data mining, or the finding of historical patterns driven by random, not real, relationships. Consider the various claims as to what drove the election results. They include local health outcomes, education and not income, how much or how little the local unemployment rate fell, and how high or low local GDP was. In truth, none of these predicted anything. Each analysis told us what already occurred. Post-election, the data was sifted, and a line was drawn where Trump voters outnumbered Clinton voters. This is classic data mining, and it should never be relied upon to make future forecasts. The parallels to investing are obvious. Salespeople love to show you backtested strategies, many of which do the exact same sort of data mining these election postmortems did. They work perfectly in the past, but cannot tell us what might occur in the future. Investors and political pundits should beware. I'm Barry Ritholtz, a columnist for Bloomberg View. For more Bloomberg opinion and commentary, please go to BloombergView.com or View Go on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Thank you, Barry. We're wrapping up one of the busiest holiday shopping seasons of the year. Though the number of shoppers grew over the weekend, the National Retail Federation found the average amount consumers spent fell 3.5%, including both online and offline. David Weston and Julie Hyman talk with two CEOs about the weekend. They begin with HSN's Mindy Grossman.
Most of us know Home Shopping Network, HSN,
right.
But you have a lot of other brands.
Yeah,
we have
a portfolio of six brands from luxury all the way across, like Frontgate, Ballard Designs, Grandin Road, Garnet Hill. So really across the spectrum of both consumer and product.
So that gives you a pretty good insight into what's going on right now in this holiday shopping season. What do you know from the weekend?
Well, a combination certainly of our businesses and what I know from NRF and all of retail. I mean, people were engaged, I think, post-election they came in, but they were really driven by the deals and promotions they were seeing. And our perspective is it's not Cyber Monday, it's cyber every day mm-hmm. at this point. And I think people have an expectation of what they are going to pay for, and they're buying what they want, but they're waiting.
Mindy, you mentioned value, you mentioned discounts, and that really leads me to a question about margins. And I guess what I'm really asking is, can the business make it up on volume? Because this instant comparison across the world about prices has to drive down margins.
Yeah, well, that's the big question. You know, I think we're all talking about sales, and it really is going to come down to margins. And what I've seen just in the past week is deeper discounting than we've ever seen before, and that on top of shipping and handling. So we're all very focused on how do we drive differentiation in product. That's been a big focus for us in terms of engagement, in terms of exclusivity, in terms of events. We had about six live performances with Keith Urban and his guitars. We're trying to do things like customization and personalization in our new Ballard Design stores. We had in-store monogramming that was driving its own traffic, treating the customer like a VIP, investing more in exclusivity of product, investing more in the talent that can do that, and that's a big focus.
Now, in terms of costs, not only, I imagine, are you seeing the discounting pressures, right? I would imagine you're also seeing, in terms of shipping, yes, you have lower oil prices, but on the flip side, people want stuff now. They want stuff 5 minutes ago, right? So you have that pressure, and you have wage pressures, presumably, as well. So how much are you seeing those costs go up, and how are you balancing that?
Look, shipping and handling is a reality that we're all facing. It's, at the end of the day, it's what the consumer wants that we're going to have to address to be competitive. It's why you're seeing seasonal so much closer, because the consumer thinks they had it. So you have to use the other levers in your business to be able to balance that, and that's gross margin, that's exclusivity of product, that's differentiation, that's the experience that you're creating for the customer, whether it be in a store or in your digital experience. And that's what has to differentiate people today.
That was Mindy Grossman, the CEO of HSN. Now, one of the last things Grossman talked about in the interview was shipping and handling costs. Well, David Westin and Julie Hyman also talked about the holiday shopping season with the CEO of one of the biggest package delivery companies in the world, UPS. Here's part of their conversation with David Abney.
Yeah, David, we got off to a very good start. You know, we've been planning peak season since the beginning of the year. And our volume over the weekend came in about where we planned, obviously higher than last year. And we look forward to another record-setting peak season, which we think we'll see.
So an important part of your job, as well as your colleagues at UPS, is planning for this season, trying to anticipate how much capacity you need. How much of an increase are you projecting, and how much are you prepared for?
Well, this year we're going to deliver over 700 million packages between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and that's an increase of 14% over last year. But we're certainly ready to handle that increased loads.
And David, obviously we have seen the shipping grow by leaps and bounds along with online shopping. It doesn't seem like it's going to slow down anytime soon. Is there a level at which the capacity, not just for you all, but for sort of the global logistics system, is going to be too much to handle? Is there a place, I mean, are we far from that place at this point?
Speaking for UPS, I can tell you that through working with our customers that we have increased capacity. We'll continue to do that as the demand increases. But we're adding people. We added aircraft, vehicles, buildings, temporary buildings. So it's really making sure that we collaborate for our customers, find out what they need, add the capacity, give our customers more control. And then the commitment of all of our UPSers around the world to make absolutely sure that we meet the needs of our customers.
So speaking of customers, how directly correlated is your growth to Amazon's growth as a practical matter?
You know, for our network, we couldn't correlate our growth to any one customer. No customer would be responsible for 10% or more of our revenue, but obviously, all of the retailers, the big e-tailers, and the large brick-and-mortar retailers as a group certainly affect what our volume would increase at this time of year.
David, as you know, we have a new president-elect, and I wonder what your internal planning tells you about what a Donald Trump presidency could mean for you. And, for example, I can think of three issues. One is consumer spending. If there really is growth, it could be more in consumer spending. Number two is infrastructure, if they invest in infrastructure. But number three is trade, because an important part of UPS's growth is tied to international growth and international sales. What do you project out into 2017 and beyond?
You know, we look forward to working with this administration just like we have in our past 109 years. And we're really, our focus, and we think it's something we have common ground with the administration, is increasing American competitiveness. And that's certainly adding infrastructure makes a big, big difference. Corporate tax reform, we think, is a big part of that. Making sure that we have rules and regulations that encourage technology and productivity gains. And then, of course, trade. We believe that trade is very important and that trade agreements will help even the playing field across the world with the United States.
So are you or your colleagues in touch with the Trump transition team already to try to talk about what's going to happen, for example, at Treasury or at Commerce?
You know, we, with any administration, we work together and We've had conversations, I think it's been with staff members and the like, but we, as the administration comes into office, we will certainly have much more time to discuss the key issues and just explain how we think we can accomplish making America much more competitive than we have been in recent years.
David, as you know, one of the market reactions already to the election has been a surge in the U.S. dollar, a surge in rates. We've seen at least the dollar versus a basket of currencies up around 4% since the election. What kind of effect is that going to have on your business? I believe you all get anywhere from a fifth to a quarter of your revenue from outside of the U.S.
You know, currencies and the way they fluctuate is certainly something that we pay a lot of attention to. Now, we do hedge, so that gives us, some protection over temporary gains. But it's not just the currency you have to look at. You have to look at the strength of the dollar and how that affects exports to the rest of the world and how it also affects imports coming into the U.S. So we're looking at a balanced network, and currency fluctuations is one of those things that's a factor.
That was UPS CEO David Abney and HSN CEO Mindy Grossman speaking earlier with Bloomberg's David Westin and Julie Hyman.
And that's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best.
If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go.
Our show is produced by David Sucherman, Robert Bragg, and Richard Truman. I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Named the most innovative investment bank for climate change and sustainability by The Banker. That's the power of global connections. Bank of America, North America. Member FDIC.